Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 5th, 2005. This session is Take Off Your Shoes, The Rescuer as Divine Agent, presented by Rabbi Robert Marks. Disc number MAR-2005-02. Let's listen in.
Were they Israelites or were they not Israelites? And does it matter? And if so, why does it matter? Since this is our observance of Independence Day, we are going to raise some questions of independence and seek some biblical insights into the meaning of true independence and sometimes of the sacrifices it takes. I'm reminded that we're observing here at Holden Village July 4th, a day late. And my grandson came downstairs a few years ago and tried to fool me. He said, "Dad, do they celebrate July 4th in England?" And I think I fell for it. Which proves something. I'm just saying this while people still come in. I was reading Ian Pier's very fine book, The Dream of Scipio, in which one of the characters in about the 3rd or 4th century is named Sophia. And she is talking to her patron and says to him, you know, she says, I really like talking to Jews. She said, because they disagree with everything. And then she went on to say, and sometimes they disagree with themselves. So that, in a sense, is what the Midrashic process is all about. And in the disagreements, in the logic of the disagreements, in the Midrash, one can unearth truths that come out of the dilemmas of life. I must tell you that my rebellion in life, and here I'm getting a little more philosophical than I'd like to for this early in our session, is against a sense that thinking is an easy process, that coming to decisions is an easy process. And sometimes, as we're going to see this week and next week, the decisions are spontaneous, but they come out of a lot of background in which you have to think through what your real convictions are, in which you have to really understand your convictions and not simply be swayed by what you hear, by the facile comments of other people. And that's what our session today is going to begin to deal with. Because in order to understand the real significance of taking off the shoes, the real thing that happened there at the burning bush, which we're going to get to, you have to really probe what is the philosophy, what are the conflicts, what is the content of the decisions that preceded. We're going to start by reading about the midwives and ask some questions about them, and then we're going to go ahead. We're going to read Exodus chapter 1, verse 15 to 22. So if you will turn in your Bibles to those passages, and Karen will lead us.
Said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was called Shifra and the other Pua, when you act as midwives for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him, but if it is a girl, she shall live. But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, why have you done this and allowed the boys to live? The midwives said to Pharaoh, "The because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them. So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded to all his people...
Okay, thank you. And the Hebrew... for this passage is chapter verse 22 and Vayehi ki yarhu hamiyal dot et ha Elohim vayah lahem batim. He made for them families. Made for them literally houses. Houses, not families. Look at the distinction. Made for them houses. Now the discussion of whether the midwives were Hebrew or not Hebrew raises the question. Well, what question does it raise? Why would this be even a subject of interest to anybody? Why, whether the midwives, they're called the Hebrew midwives, why? Why would this be important? Yes?
Well, the firstborn son of the Israelite families were to be dedicated and consecrated to the Lord.
Right.
Well, that's, to me, what is of interest, and Pharaoh has commanded that these infants be killed, and so I see in that passage that if they were Hebrew midwives, they were honoring God and the commandment to protect life. I mean, life was so sacred.
Well, you're raising a very interesting thing that should be pointed out, and that is in many cultures, but especially in the ancient Israel culture, it is the firstborn. That inherits, and it's the firstborn son too, that inherits Zelophehad's daughter chapter of the Bible, where the daughters rebel against being excluded from this birthright, is a very significant little counter chapter to this idea. But certainly, the firstborn are children. But do you notice something absolutely beautiful in the Bible, how stories repeat themselves, how themes repeat over and over again. And look at the repetition of rivalry between brothers, for instance, over and over again in the early books of the Bible. This rivalry between brothers takes place, Cain and Abel being the first one. What else? Quick, you tell me. You Bible geniuses, tell me. I'm thirsting to know. Somebody said Jacob and Esau, right? And there are no others? Joseph and his brothers. Full of rivalry, too. And even if you're very careful to notice, David's children, certainly.
David's brothers, yeah.
And if you're very careful to notice, there's the theme. I'm going to point it out now because it's not relevant to what I'm going to do, but it is here. There's a theme of Moses deferring to his brother, to his older brother Aaron. That whole theme in Moses, which people have underplayed, but I'm going to point it out now, that Moses... says, compared to my brother, I'm not very eloquent. He was very eloquent, but we're going to see today why he wasn't eloquent, in a literal sense at least, but he didn't feel eloquent compared to his brother. But let me get back to the question again, though, which has not been answered. Why does it make a difference whether the midwives, why would it make a difference in terms of for us, reading it today here at Holden Village in the year 2005 on July 4th plus one. Yes.
I don't believe they were Hebrews. I believe that they were Egyptians, and God worked through them. So we're seeing an inclusive God.
All right. It would be more inclusive then if they were Egyptians. All right. What do you think?
Well, if they were Egyptians, they were also acting in defiance of their government. Mm-hmm.
That's very good. Mm-hmm. So the question is, and if they were Israelites, they wouldn't be acting in defiance of their government?
They would be, but not a government of their choice. I mean, not a government of their birth.
In other words, and I think what you're saying, any other comments before? I tell you what I think you're saying. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, you know what? I confess to you, I put on my reading glasses this morning, and everything is a blur except the So please just do what you did. Let me know you're there. I want you to. Yes.
But it raises the question of who is responsible for the salvation of the redemption, salvation, you know, from Egypt of Israel? Is it Israelites themselves, or is it others who are there? And especially, it's women oftentimes in the book of Exodus.
Very good. Well, let's take your last little phrase. Of course, it's critical to understand that whether they were Israelite women or Egyptian women, these are women who are responsible for the salvation of Israel. And they get short shrift. I think they got to edit it out later on. No, that happened. I think that happened a lot. I hate to say it, but the Bible took a while. This is the Word of God, of course. But the Word of God gets misheard by a lot of people, at least in my Bible.
Another
yes.
thing is, I wouldn't imagine that they would share midwives. Like, the Egyptians would probably have different women to deliver the Egyptian babies than they would to deliver the Hebrew babies. So whether or not the midwives themselves were Israelite or Egyptian, they might have only been relegated to delivering the Hebrew babies.
What would that make them? Israelite midwives, you say?
Well, whether they were or not. Maybe I'm just reading a little into it, but would they have shared midwives? Like, would midwives have delivered both Egyptian and Hebrew babies?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. Let's see. Well, let us understand that when yesterday, as you remember, we talked about there arose a new king over Egypt who knew not Joseph. Vayakam Melech Hadash. He knew not Joseph. And what is the reason that they were upset? One of the reasons was that the Israelites had spread all over. Remember that they'd forgotten circumcision, which was a metaphorical excuse, metaphorical description of their abandonment of Judaism, of the Israelite customs. And they were spread all over and the proof of that, the proof text, was that when God spared the Israelite children during the night of the Seder, during the night of the Passover deliverance, God had to pass, there needed to be a mark on the door of the Israelite houses so that the angel would pass over those houses with a mark. So there was pretty much integration, right? I mean, I think we can assume that integration had occurred. And one of the things that I lamented yesterday was how people who can live together in harmony, and I think this ought to be studied more, can suddenly become bitter enemies.
Except that you know, I think, you know, what we know about midwifery is that historically, midwives come out of a clan. And so, you know, a clan will have their own midwife. Or so, you know, so a family. And so, I mean, to me it would make sense that there would be midwives who are of Hebrew descent, but Pharaoh has to have a way to control and know who that firstborn is. So Pharaoh, you know, has to have control, and the only way for Pharaoh to know who those firstborn children are is to have someone in his camp, whether it's a Hebrew midwife who's in his camp or an Egyptian midwife who's in his camp who's attending the Hebrew women.
In other words, these midwives, regardless of who they are under Pharaoh's control.
Under Pharaoh's control.
Under Pharaoh's control. Okay. Under Pharaoh's control, but under God's control. Mm-hmm. See, and that's the paradox.
It doesn't say the firstborn. It says they kill all the male children. Does that matter?
all the male children. But it's interesting because later on, when the angel of death passes over the Egyptian houses, it's the firstborn sons that are killed. So what Pharaoh wants to do is a form of population control, but by killing all the males, so that there can be no, and that would ultimately kill the females if there's not, or at least, or lead to a Mormon style of polygamous system. Yes?
I'm just curious if the two names that are mentioned are significant. Are they Hebrew names? Are they not? Are they Egyptian names?
And the Midrash comments on that in very interesting forms. Midrash says they're Egyptian names. See, they were Egyptian names, they were Egyptians, but, says the Midrash, they were so good that they converted to Judaism. Now, the point whether they're Israelite or not, any other comments? Yes.
Yeah, it seems to me like if the firstborn are killed, if the firstborn sons are killed, it also kills the spirit of the family, of the Jewish family, because that, there's so much riding on that firstborn son.
There, it certainly would do that, and that's what it was intended to do.
Yeah.
It was intended to crush the spirit.
I just want to make a comment about the humor in this, too, that the midwives were so creative in how they defied Pharaoh. Well, the Hebrew women are so vigorous that, they were before we come in. Sometimes we miss the humor of these things.
I'm glad you pointed that out, because it always struck me as that it's a wonderful line that they're so vigorous. And while you're talking, I'm thinking of another midrash that said, and this is pretty gory, that the Egyptian taskmasters in the middle of the night would make the Israelite slaves go out to work, and they would come in to their wives in the dark so that the wives didn't know. Oh, sirs, who it was that was coming in to visit them in the middle of the night. Anyhow, there's a lot of humor in the midst of something that is really very, very tragic.
And they could never have said that to a woman. They could only have said that to a man.
Yes, I would have believed that.
Now, one more thing. I missed that last time.
I said only a man would have believed that.
I want to tell you, the Midrash tells this story with an absolute straight face. The men absolutely believed their wives when they said to them, "I thought it was you, honey." But this is a very holy and pious camp, and I don't want to dwell too long. But I just want to show you how very confusing. Look at verse 22 again, if you will. I'm sorry, verse 21. Will you read it for me again, Karen, please? Because I want to point out one more thing before we go on.
And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families.
All right. And it came, my version is, and it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that he made them houses. Batim, houses. He made them houses. Now, you read families, which is interesting. And that's what I wanted you to do. I really wanted to hear correctly that you had said families. But the Hebrew is batim. And what is the assumption? Whom, you know, when you read your version, what do you assume? They would have their own children. And who did that? Who made them families?
God.
God. And isn't the he with a capital letter? that he, God, made them families?
No.
It is not capitalized.
No.
Okay. Well, that's better, because my English, my Hebrew doesn't have any capital, but my English does have a capital for he. So, but isn't the assumption that God did that? God gave them families? The Midrash says something different. That because these midwives were so sassy and so quick with their comments, that Pharaoh made them separate housing, where they had to stay segregated. An entirely different reading that is totally legitimate. He made them, that because they feared God, Pharaoh, in retaliation, made separate houses for them. Entirely different. Isn't that fascinating? Yes.
How does that reconcile with verse 22, where then Pharaoh has all his people killing the sons?
Oh, yeah. All his people. Well, those midwives weren't very reliable.
All Egyptian people.
Well, that's a different sentence. You're taking me beyond the sentence I wanted to. How could I? All right, how would you answer your own question, seriously? You answer it. Tell me what you would say.
I don't think the Midrash can be correct, because it sounds to me like Pharaoh couldn't reward them with houses when he charged all his people that the firstborn...
But he doesn't say he rewarded them with houses. He put them in houses.
He segregated them.
He segregated them into houses. And then that didn't work. Okay? Couldn't one read it that way? And time passed, and it still didn't work very well. So we ordered everybody to do it. And stop and think about it. Look at Bosnia, but look at the Holocaust. Well, I mean, what does it start? I mean, segregation, it doesn't happen all at once. I mean, we Jews experienced this for the Munich Games, you know, the Olympic Games, where Jews weren't allowed to participate. And then all of a sudden you'd find businesses closed. And then you'd find Kristallnacht in November, where the synagogues were all burnt. And then you'll find Jews disappearing from their homes. So hatred occurs incrementally, in small, small doses. And it creeps. And if you really wonder, you know, this is a story of something that happened thousands and thousands of years ago. Forgive it for not being so graphic and historically correct and connected as it might be, but it's telling our story today. It's telling what's happening in Darfur. It's telling what's happening in so many places. And good people always sit back and say, oh, isn't that too bad? Because the question is, what can we do? What should we do? And where can we do it? This whole series of lectures I'm trying to share with you, and you're helping so much, because it's really such a joy to be here with you. And I've said that before in previous years, but it always is. Because I think this is a group that wants to see it, that wants to understand, wants to do something. And when you're talking about taking off your shoes, you're talking about what each one of us can begin to think to do, so that when the time comes to do, we can do it. The problem I always share with my congregation is, you know, it's easy to give a litany of all the bad things that are happening in the world. I mean, we can just go and say how terrible it is and how awful it is. But the big question is, what steps can we take to do something about it? What little steps can we take? And when a decisive time comes, and for some people in history there is a decisive time, and for Moses that decisive time comes when he stands before the bush that is burning and will not go out, and he hears somehow or other a voice that says, take off your shoes. He's able to listen in a brand new way and to do something in a new way. Okay?
pharaoh's need, desire, but it doesn't make what the midwives did wrong.
No, it certainly makes what the midwives did right. And the question with which I began today was, does it make any difference whether they're Hebrew midwives or whether they're Egyptian midwives? In the final analysis, in terms of their saving lives, it doesn't. The question, though, is, does a people only save its own people? I mean, this is another decision. In other words, would the Hebrew midwives have been expected to act this way, and so it's perfectly logical that they save their own, you know, their own children? Or were the Egyptian midwives doing something that was extra courageous? Were they going beyond the bounds in order to save their children? That's right.
Yeah.
The saving is the same.
And we certainly have many stories of courageous people, Holocaust is the one that we can most call up, where the families hid Jewish people and sent the Jewish children to Scandinavia in great sacrifice.
But wouldn't you say, and agreeing with what both of you are saying, wouldn't you also say that during the Holocaust, I certainly would have, one would have expected Jews to do what they could to save Jews, but when a non-Jew acted to save a Jew, I mean, when Anne Frank was sheltered by non-Jews in the attic and then betrayed by somebody, one sort of gives an extra credit when somebody saves, my mind is wandering now to Civil War days when white families in the North would take in black families, and you would expect black families to shelter one another. If you read Beloved, for instance, that beautiful novel about the slavery days. But when a non-member of the group saves, there seems to be an extra act of heroism. I remember when I was a little bit of reminiscence, when I was a teenager, I belonged to a congregation, a large urban congregation in Cleveland, Ohio, and we had a debating team. And the debating team would go and debate large congregations, youth groups in other cities. And I, being destined to be a nonstop talker, decided that I would join the debating team. And I remember the debate topics were always, I remember in college the debate topic was, should there be universal military service or not? And one time you would take the positive side and one time you would take the negative side. And I remember we'd have reams of file cards, and during the debate we'd leap through the file cards, pull out the one and say, aha, eureka, I found an answer to your stupid comment. We waved these cards. Well, but I think I was 14 years old at the time, and our debate team was debating in Detroit, Michigan. And our temple sent us on from Cleveland, Ohio to Detroit, Michigan, and we were housed by the families in Detroit. And then came the day of the debate, and the debate was this. Resolve that the Nazi government in Germany is sending Jews to concentration camps. Now remember, this was a debate topic in those days. For Holocaust deniers, alas, it still is a debate topic. But in those, you know, each one of us has known scores of families that have been decimated by the Holocaust. It's not even an amusingly interesting debate topic anymore. But this was 1941. We didn't know. So I would take the affirmative and would feel quite comfortable with it. And I remember in Detroit, I was on the negative side. I had to say, no. Now, what were my arguments? My arguments were, well, remember in World War I, how there were stories of gassings in Belgium and all sorts of German atrocities in Belgium, and they never occurred. Okay, and And I use this sort of thing as an example, how during war, people like to make atrocity stories and exaggerate atrocities. So I was talking about how obviously this is an exaggeration, that there's anti-Semitism, but that certainly Jews aren't being sent to concentration camps. Little did we know on that day that 6 million Jews were in the process of being sent to their deaths at Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen and elsewhere. And as I'm talking, somebody up in the balcony, and I couldn't see him any better than I could see the balcony. Somebody up in the balcony stood up and he screamed. He said, "How can you say that? How can you say that? Look!" And he pulled his arm back, and there, for everyone in the balcony to see, was a concentration camp number burnt into his skin. He had just escaped and gone to Detroit to tell a story. Well, you can imagine what a lesson that was. You know, just being there, realizing. Yes.
Or a comment. Going back to the midwives, I think if I were Pharaoh, I would not let a slave group control themselves. I would want to have somebody there who was on my side and who could be spies for me to let me know what was going on. So that would say that those midwives would be Egyptian. And then to go back to the comment about, so God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, comma, he gave them families or houses. To me, sentence structure, that he refers to God, and God gave them not, and to me, if you say houses, that tells me God gave them not just their little family, God continued their line, God blessed their line. And so that reflects on us today, our rewards for doing small things, brave things, out of the ordinary things, are blessed by God in a very spectacular way to all our generations.
I'm listening to you with great respect, and at the same time I'm thinking of something funny.
Well, okay, that's fine.
Two guys, man goes to visit his rabbi, and rabbi says, "Just sit there. I got two people who have an argument, and they're coming in. And you just sit in the corner and listen to it." And one guy came in and he said, "This Goneth, this thief, owes me 2,000 rubles." And the rabbi looks at him and says, "You're right." And the other guy sitting there, he says, "You haven't heard me, rabbi." He says, "I paid him back his 2,000 rubles." And the rabbi says, "You're right." And the guy sitting on the corner says, "But rabbi, how can you say to both of them, you're right?" The rabbi looks at him, he says, "You're right." And I'm going to tell you, you're right. Because the Midrash will tell you that story too. In other words, the Midrashic story in here, and then I'm going to go on if we have some time. The Midrash, one Midrash will say that Pharaoh controlled the midwives and built houses in order to segregate them so that they would be under his control better. And another Midrash says, because the midwives acted to save, that God rewarded them with families. Now, they translate batim with families. In other words, they were happily, they hadn't been married before. Now they're happily married with families. You see, so that both of those are sort of, that's a beautiful, beautiful part of our midrash. But it starts us to think about what, well, why don't you take your meaning that you prefer? Now, let me get to something hard. Let us turn to an article in the Christian Century. that I thought was applicable to today's session. This was in the latest issue that I saw of the Christian Century, which, do any of you subscribe to the Christian Century? I'm sure some of you do, right?
Yeah.
Quite a few of you do. All right. It's on the liberal side of the Christian viewpoint. I think many of you would find many of the articles interesting. There was an article that I found fascinating in the June 28th article of the Christian Century about just the topic we're dealing with, but as it applies to today, as it is relevant today. So take a look at this article, and Karen, our dedicated reader, is going to start reading for us. And please interrupt as you go along, because this is written, I think, by an army chaplain, by obviously a Protestant chaplain, probably ELCA member. and let's see what he has to say, okay?
One soldier said that he felt he lost his soul when he had to pick up body parts of his friends after they were blown apart by an improvised explosive device, IED. He asked me if he could ever get his soul back. Another soldier said it is impossible to be a Christian in war. Since many in the group were committed Christians, this comment sent a kind of electric shock around the circle. You cannot kill and love at the same time, he said.
What a pause. That's pretty profound. Isn't this the terrible problem? We're not going to solve this problem today, I hate to tell you. But it certainly is a relevant problem for all of us. You cannot kill and love at the same time. And it's fascinating how when soldiers go to war, part of the training invariably is to be able to kill, which suppresses the feeling of love. Yes?
You know, for your own sanity, you have to separate those two. If you're in the service, I mean, that's why we have so much in the way of trouble after the war.
Yeah.
Because people were not able to separate.
The traumatic shock after
yes,
the war.
Right.
I think you're absolutely right. But it is very, very difficult, particularly, for a good Christian. Certainly for a good Jew, too, who is trained to, I would say the word operative for a Christian would be love. Would that be correct? Would that be fair to say? And for a Jew, it would be life. L'chaim. We say l'chaim when everything is life. When we, at a Jewish summit, Jim, is we Jim here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You were asking me about what we do after death, right? We praise life. Jews do it. The prayer, the Kaddish prayer, is a praise to the God of life. So, how do you reconcile life and death? I mean, you're right, you could go crazy dealing. But let's see how this works out.
I was just going to say the name that pops to mind, suffering over that question, is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who suffered so badly deciding.
And I'm going to deal with it.
You're right.
And you're right.
Some agreed with this soldier, while others took great offense at his comment. This was one of the few times that I made an explicitly theological intervention in the group and put aside my role of group facilitator. I asked the group...
Now, here's why I'm interested in this, because... What this chaplain does in terms of World War II. And so, I mean, we could spend endless hours dealing with how you can go to war, and we should do that. I mean, really, all religious people should deal with that question, because we are faced with a basic conflict when that comes up. No matter how we deal with it, we have a basic conflict. But let's see this question that he's raising.
I asked the group to think about a soldier in World War II who crosses a hill and beholds the gates of a concentration camp. He sees the guards standing at the gate, and he also sees the gaunt prisoners in their striped uniforms being led to a gas chamber behind the guard. At this point, he has a choice, and I asked the group to reflect on this choice. Let's suppose, I said, that our soldier is a Christian. Jesus taught that love is to be a sign of his disciples, John 13:35, and further that love is of enemies is to be the defining feature of Christian love, the very thing that defines Christian perfection, Matthew 5:43-48. And yet it seems that killing will take place before his eyes one way or another. Either he will do nothing while the inmates are led to their death, or he can fill his sights with that German guard, pull the trigger, and begin stopping the march for the ovens. In short, this soldier is forced to decide whom to love. Does he love the German guard so much that he does not kill him? Or does he love the inmates so much that he does kill the guard? Christians are told to love all people. But sometimes, I told that group, the world, this world that God created, but a world that is also broken and sinful, makes us choose whom we will love. Sometimes we are presented with a Sophie's choice in which none of the options are pure and good. If we want to love the group of Iraqi women with purple fingers fresh from the voting booth, then we will shoot and kill the insurgent who is racing his bomb-laden car toward the polls. There was silence in the room. A few heads slowly nodded. There was nothing else to say. They were not silent out of respect for my rank or position, but that had not stopped them from voicing their own views, at times quite vociferously. Their eyes said, "That's how it is downrange. No John Wayne heroism for glory, medals, and honor. Just simple, terrifyingly hard choices that often have to be made in a split second. No high-minded just war theory juxtaposed against the simple pieties of pacifism. The world sometimes makes us choose whom to love. That's it." The brokenness that comes from having to make those heart-rending choices is captured in a conversation that I had many years ago with a retired active duty Army chaplain. This true Southern gentleman was in many ways the stereotype of a gallant, patriotic soldier, a decorated Vietnam veteran who proudly displayed his uniform at our annual conference gatherings. Yet this same man once told me something that left me slack-jawed with surprise. "The military uniform," he said, "is humanity's badge of shame."
Let's pause for a minute. I want to read the last paragraph because any reactions to this?
My father would do that.
Pardon?
My father, who served, I mean, he's, the only stories he's ever told us are the stories of his horrifying emotions when comrades died or when he had to shoot and kill. And on the one hand he says we need a military, and on the other hand he says, but it is our voice of shame.
I'm not going to voice any opinion about this passage. I'm just sharing it with you as part of the terrible dilemmas, part of the terrible agonies that one faces. I think it's true that a nation needs to protect itself, but needs armies, and yet the killing of people is. How do we make the decision? Well, I think this whole take off your shoes is that question. If you stop and think about it. It's that question of bare, I'm going to talk about the shoes later on this week, but it's that symbol of bare nakedness before God, where you stand and say, "God, I don't know what to do. What am I going to do? What about that guy who goes into the concentration camp and sees people being led to the ovens? What's he doing? What if he was a German soldier sitting there? And a German Christian soldier? What if he was a Dietrich Bonhoeffer? Well, we know what Dietrich did, but how many of us are Dietrich Bonhoeffers? And that's the terrible pain. Yes.
We're not faced with these. Most of us won't be in a position where we have to shoot someone, but we are often faced with opportunities where people are being ridiculed and are persecuted in some way, maybe of mind or emotion, and we do have choices there. We can take some actions, and I think God sets us up for those with divine appointments to test us and to let us speak out or help to protect those other people that cannot protect themselves so much.
You know, I am grateful to you, more grateful to you than you will know, for having said what you just said. Because what is this all about? It's about each of us taking those little steps that prevent us coming to the point where people are killing each other as they did in Somalia, for instance, or Darfur today, or Bosnia, where there are such hatreds. How do we take those steps that prevent it? That's worth all the Camp Holden, you know, piety in the world, if we could hear in this small little village, which is so representative of people of goodwill, if we could come to some sort of a stance that would lead us to understand the real agony of making decisions and how we can make decisions much earlier in the process than at that ultimate point.
Can I make a comment also?
Yeah,
what
please.
I would say in that standing up in that defense, we need to be better at loving both people you're talking to. It's not about just defending the defenseless by attacking and angry language and all that. I mean, the thing is, how do you love and respect both people when you are defending the poor? It's that loving both, you know, loving all in this respectful dialogue.
I'm going to spare Karen now. I'm going to ask you to read the last paragraph. You read it from up there. You have the text? Read the last paragraph, because that's just what you're saying. Karen, you've read it.
Few would debate the proposition that war is one of the worst realities that can befall humanity. And from that point of view, it is hard to disagree with my friend's assessment. But then he said something else. If the military uniform is humanity's badge of shame, he added, wouldn't Jesus count those who wear it as his disciples?
And you're saying that in a little different way. Mm-hmm. Do you realize that? Or don't you? Or don't you accept that?
Yeah, I do.
In other words, you're saying that the people who are expressing their prejudices have to be understood too. I think you're saying that.
Yes.
And we have to learn how to deal with that. We need to be a lot wiser.
I have a comment?
Yes. Over here. Several. Are there two hands up there?
Yeah, two hands.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
The whole discussion of, you know, you've got your sights on a guard and the guard is leading people to their death assumes that there's different weights to killing and that the consequences of one or the other are different. So if you allow the guard to proceed and kills 100 people, that's worse than me shooting the guard. But I think there's another possible underlying dynamic to be the one. I believe that every act of killing is part of a whole, and that whole is the beast that we're trying to get rid of, and you cannot get rid of it by joining it. And so if that dynamic were presented and you say, you know, we're going to go kill these people, but the result is we're simply continuing the killing, and that's a reality, and we accept that reality, then we could not proceed in that direction with any argument.
In my work, I deal with people who are facing the death penalty, and they're all murderers. And I, just as war is a result of public policy, the policies that lead to war are made by people in Washington, D.C. And, you know, it isn't the foot soldier out there deciding, it's the policies that led to that place. I would argue that most of my clients who have murdered people on the streets of Chicago have done so as a result of our public policy. They've done so, my job is to look at their lives, look at the history of their lives. And you see the result of our policies of creating poverty, sustaining poverty, not providing loving care to children who are poor, not providing education to their parents so that their parents could help them with their homework, not providing a lead-free and toxin-free environments for them to live in. I mean, our policies result in people murdering each other on the streets of Chicago. And that most of these young people who do this would argue finally that they did it to save their own lives, which is, you know, you could say a soldier might do the same thing in war. I mean, they're actually called foot soldiers in the gangs on the streets of Chicago, but I think it's the same thing.
Ingrid Chris Johnson deals with one of the most painful of all our social dilemmas. And we've heard the whole gamut of theories today.
And then we respond to them by killing them. So we respond to violence, which we have engendered through our policy, by having another policy that says we, as the state, get to kill them.
Other comments?
We have a pastor that has retired from our church. He's just the most compassionate person you'd ever want to meet. And he's 80. And he said as he's getting older, he's discovered that the most important thing is to simply be kind to one another. And it sounds like an oversimplification, but you think of these people that you're speaking of, if people had been kind to them, if we were kind to one another, imagine what the world would be like.
Now, nobody was kind to my clients when they were children. I guarantee you that.
Other comments? I was going to deal with Moses' childhood today. I don't think I could get to that. I wanted to get into Moses because what we're leading up to, and I don't want to leave myself frustrated any more than I want to leave you frustrated, but I do feel called upon to say that what we've dealt with this morning is one of the most basic of all religious issues. There can be nothing more holy than holy people asking, what are the boundaries of human conduct? Where do we promote life? And what life is it that we want to safeguard and cherish? And how do we want to do this? We are seeing an act that allowed one man to live. How interwoven are the acts we perform? If it had not been for two unnamed ladies, were they Egyptian? Were they Jewish? Who knows? Who really cares? Were it not for the courageous little act that they did, the course of history would not have unraveled the way it did, and we could not follow Moses to that bush where he hears a voice that no one else heard. Take off your shoes. Take off your shoes. And something magical and holy happens that changes the course of history. Were it not for those ladies, two ladies, who were courageous, but also I would have liked to know them because they knew how to laugh. Have a good Independence Day.